Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk, our podcast from the Scottish Book Trust. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. And what we've done for this particular episode is we've packed it jam-packed full of young adult fiction writers. We've got three fantastic authors on the podcast, which I think you're really going to enjoy. Even if you don't usually normally read young adult fiction, I've been dipping into it a whole lot more than I normally do. And actually, I find it incredibly worthwhile and really enjoyable. And some of the themes and the depth of the work that we're going to explore on this podcast is really, really interesting and engaging. So on today's podcast, we've got David Levithan talking about his book Every Day, which is brilliant. We've got Leigh Bardugo talking about her Grisha trilogy, which is epic and exciting. And we're going to start the podcast with an interview from Garth Nix. He's written a book called Clarial, which is kind of a prequel to the Old Kingdom series. And our own Sasha Dabul conducted the interview. Here he is, Garth Nix.
I'm Garth Nix, and I'm here to talk about my new book, Clarial. Clarial is a prequel to my Old Kingdom trilogy, which consists of Sabriel, Lyrael, and Abhorsen. It's a fantasy novel, what people often call high fantasy, which means it takes place in an invented world, in this case, the Old Kingdom. And Clarial is the story of a young woman who is made to go and live in the main city, the city of Belisaire, by her parents. Her mother is a very famous goldsmith who moves to the capital city to have more opportunities, and Clarial's forced to go with them. But she doesn't want to go. She's 17 years old. She wants to strike out on her own, and she particularly wants to live in the great forest and be a hunter. She's a loner who likes to be out amongst the trees and live her own life. And she moves to the city because she has to, but then she'll do almost anything to get out of it again. And she's drawn into various plots and complications to do with power struggles between the king, who she's related to, the guilds, and at the same time, there are ancient evil powers at work once again in the Old Kingdom.
So obviously the Old Kingdom books came out a little while ago. I think Abhorsen came out in 2003. What was it that made you want to come back to the series and keep telling stories set there?
Well, they've actually been around a long time, really. Sabriel first came out in Australia in 95, in the US in 96. I had the idea for Clarial a long time ago. In fact, I made a note about Clarial while I was writing Lyrael, the second book in the trilogy. And it's just taken me this long to get around to it. I've been writing lots of other books. And that idea, the basic idea for that book was just lurking in the back of my mind. It just needed to move up the queue until it was the next one. I thought, I have to write this book next.
Did you find that going back to that world was difficult, having been away, or was it as if it had just, you know, been there the whole time, just waiting?
Well, I guess it had been there the whole time, just waiting, though I did have to go back and reread all the earlier books, which I don't normally do. I don't particularly like going back and rereading my earlier work. I prefer to always look ahead and write new stuff. I actually enjoyed going back and rereading those books, being reminded of all the things that I'd put into them that I had forgotten, which is why I was rereading them. So that was actually quite a pleasurable experience to reimmerse myself in that world, not just in the novels, but also I went back through my notebooks as well. So there's various little bits of odds and ends that I'd actually utterly forgotten and I needed for the new book. So it was a bit like going back to a city where you used to live for quite a long time. And some things have changed, but a lot of things are the same. You have that experience of, I know this really well, but somehow it's a bit different. So it was actually quite a pleasurable experience.
Is there a reason you wanted to tell Clarial's story in particular? Because I know that with the books, with Clarial's story in particular, like there are so many different characters in your books that sort of drop in and out that you could really run with. I mean, there's about, I would say, I could think of 10 off the top of my head that'd be like, I'd love to know more about them. Why Clarial?
That's a good question. There are lots of stories. I am, in fact, in the middle of writing another book set in the Old Kingdom, which takes place, it picks up, I guess, the main storyline from the end of Abhorsen and goes off with it in an unanticipated direction. But I think from the time when I wrote the beginning of Lyrael, I'd been thinking about Clarial. So she was a character that I really wanted to write about, even though, as you say, there's plenty of characters I could write about. And I hope perhaps that I will keep coming back to the Old Kingdom. I think it is a very rich world, and I do love working in it. So I have another book which continues the story in Lyra Ellen Abhorsen, and maybe I'll come back for more. And I write short stories too. There's a few short stories set in the Old Kingdom. One of those is To Hold the Bridge, which is the lead story in a collection of stories I have coming out in May. And it's quite a long, it's a novelette, I guess. It's a long short story. It's set around the same time as Clarial, even though the events don't connect up. But it's set around the same time as Clarial. So I do dip back into the waters quite often. And in fact, I've got another short story about Sabriel's father, which I've almost finished too. So there are lots of stories, and I think I'll keep coming back to that well.
In some of the early reviews of the book, I saw that the subtitle is Clarial, the Lost Abhorsen. Do you think she is the Lost Abhorsen? I thought that was a bit of an interesting subtitle to put on the book, given the nature of it.
It could refer to a number of different ways that you can be lost. Mm-hmm. She is the granddaughter of the current Abhorsen when the book starts. You could possibly argue, I'm trying to figure out how to say this without spoilers, you could possibly argue that all the Abhorsens of that time are lost, in the sense they're not doing their job. Her grandfather and her aunt are not doing the job of the Abhorsens. Potentially, I guess, is a bit of a spoiler. I've also talked in the past more at length about the book than I possibly should have, so there are quite a few spoilers around anyway. But I like subtitles, and I guess when I first started planning the book, it had that subtitle, and it just stuck on there. And then I couldn't take it off, I suppose. And interestingly, none of the publishers asked me to, though I'm not sure the UK edition actually has the sub. It doesn't have the subtitle. The American and the Australian ones do. Not on the cover, I don't think, just on the title page.
Something that I liked about the book is that the Old Kingdom in Clarial's time is a really different place than when you meet Sabriel or Lyriel. I mean, in Sabriel, obviously, the kingdom's in a bit of disarray, and then in Lyriel, there's sort of that rebuild period. But in this book, charter magic is almost seen as, a bad thing. It's frowned upon in polite society. People don't really practice it anymore. And even the main character is, no great charter mage herself. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose to show sort of the other side of charter magic, the dark side, perhaps?
I guess I just wanted to write a different sort of book. I wanted to go back to the Old Kingdom, but I didn't want to just replicate what I'd done before. And part of the way to do that was to show the Old Kingdom in a different period where it is very settled. And as you say, there haven't been any problems with the dead or free magic for such a long time that people have forgotten how important the Abhorsens are, how important charter magic is in maintaining the integrity of the kingdom. And I just thought it'd be interesting to have a look at how things could change if everything was very peaceful for a long time. And so the most important thing for most of the people has become money, has become trade and money. And the guilds have become the most important. And I guess I just thought that would be an interesting backdrop to the story of where there are things happening again. So it's been peaceful, but things are stirring again, things are happening. And I also did want to explore free magic, which is the other sort of side of things from charter magic, again, just to tell a different kind of story than I'd done before, while still within the familiar environs of the Old Kingdom, even though it's in a different time and is not the same as it appears in Sabriel or Lyra Ellen Abhorsen.
I thought it was really interesting because in the previous works, you have characters who don't have charter marks and who aren't connected to the charter. And they're often, sort of additional characters. They're like the red shirts in Star Trek, sort of pop in, die, leave. But in this, you have Clarial who really struggles with the charter. And it was like, all of a sudden you see the charter as almost a position of privilege that, not everybody gets to tap into. It almost also reminded me of the idea of somebody, say, who is very interested in reading, but it has dyslexia or dyspraxia or something that prevents them from engaging with it in one way. And so there was a lot of anger there. I found that very interesting.
I hope my secondary characters aren't like red shirts in Star Trek, or at least not disposed of so willy-nilly. I'm always reminded of Galaxy Quest when I think of red shirts, and the paranoia of the guy who played the red shirt in the original series is desperately afraid he's going to die. Again, I guess part of the book was also exploring charter magic and the fact that you have to learn it. you can have the talent, you can have that inborn talent, but if you don't learn it, if you're not taught it, if you don't learn the discipline of it, then you never will be a charter mage. And I guess that's part of, and part of Clariel has a very mixed heritage, in that she has inherited more of some of their other bloodlines, even though she's the granddaughter of the Abhorsen. I just wanted to have a look at that mixture of things and potential. So she has lots of different potential, and it's what she chooses to pursue, and also what circumstance and her environment has caused her to pursue. She reacts against charter magic in part because it's reaction against her mother, and her mother in turn is also rebelling against her father for a reason that's explained in the book. I wanted to tell a story which was more realistic, I think, in the sense that you didn't just automatically inherit these powers. I mean, a lot of fantasy novels, you inherit powers and you use them and that's it. Mm-hmm. There isn't any, maybe you've inherited it, but you didn't use it very well, or you didn't learn it properly. And I think that happens in real life. I mean, there are people who have great talents who don't use them very well, or don't pursue them, or choose not to, for all kinds of different reasons. And sometimes that works out well and sometimes not.
Do you specifically think that the sort of young adult genre suits that sort of, point in time with the choice element, because you do write about it so often? Is that why you're drawn to that genre?
Young adult literature is a very broad field. I think broader than it often is considered, because I think you can do a lot of different stories within that general, very broad category. But I think the late teenage years are a time where you are making decisions, setting your feet on whatever path you're going to follow towards whoever you will be, whoever you will become. And you may make missteps and go the wrong way, and all kinds of things can happen. But it is a time of big decisions and big consequences often, which is fantastic raw material for a story. Whenever you have big decisions with potentially big consequences, you have the raw material for a really interesting narrative. And I think coming-of-age stories are something that I particularly like. I like to tell them. I like to read them. Within different kinds of settings too, whether they're historical or fantasy or science fiction, I think it's a very strong human story that we all relate to, whether we're actually going through it at the time. You're a young adult yourself, or you're an older adult who's been through that, or in fact may still be in that sort of stage yourself, because it's not just something that happens when you're 18 or 19 or 20. You can still be sorting out who you are and what you're doing for decades afterwards, to different degrees. So I think people, people of all ages, once they've reached a certain age, can relate to young adult stories, and that's part of their attraction, both for writers and for readers.
Garth Nix, everybody. The book again is Clariel. It's a prequel to the Old Kingdom series. He's got three fantastic series out. Go check them out. You can find them everywhere. Also, you can find Garth Nix on Twitter at Garth Nix. And speaking of Twitter, if you're there and you decide you'd like to follow Garth Nix, why not follow the Scottish Book Trust at Scottish BK Trust? If you're not into the Twitter and you prefer Facebook, if you're one of those types of people, go ahead and look us up on Facebook and click on the thumbs up button. That means you like us and we'd really appreciate it. And of course, we've got our website, www.scottishbooktrust.com, which is full of great information and loads of exciting things. Check out our website when you get a chance. We're going to stay in the realm of fantasy, and we're going to stay in the realm of looking at books that, trilogies and long basically series. Up next on the podcast, we've got Leigh Bardugo. She's written the Grisha trilogy. The latest book from that is Ruin and Rising. It's the final book in the Grisha trilogy, and it was very exciting to hear about the concluding chapter of this tale. Here she is, Leigh Bardugo.
I'm Leigh Bardugo. I'm the author of the Grisha trilogy, Shadow and Bone, Siege and Storm, and the final book, Ruin and Rising. The series is a fantasy set in a world inspired by Tsarist Russia, specifically Tsarist Russia of the early 1800s. But it takes place in a fictional country called Ravka that has been torn in two by a swath of nearly impenetrable darkness crawling with monsters. And this swath of darkness has cut this country off from its ports and harbors. So in order to trade with the outside world, they have to send people across, and the people they usually choose are young conscripted soldiers. One of these soldiers is a girl named Alina Starkov, who is a war refugee and an orphan. She spent her whole life being unwanted and overlooked until the day her regiment enters the Shadow Fold and they're attacked, and she reveals a power that puts her on a collision course with the most powerful forces in the kingdom, including the leader of the kingdom's magical elite.
This setting is pretty rare. What was the impetus of setting something in Tsarist Russia? How did that come about? Was that a fascination for you as a kid? Is it coming back, go back to fairy tales and these kind of things? Because there's little elements and notes of that throughout the books as well. I think you called it Tsar Punk at one point, even.
Well, Tsar Punk sort of started out as a joke, because most fantasy, or a lot of fantasy, although this is changing quite a lot, is set in worlds that are inspired usually by medieval England, medieval Europe. That's kind of the most common cultural touchstone. And I wanted to take readers someplace a little bit different. Although whenever I would talk to somebody and pitch the book, I'd say, well, it's fantasy. But then they would think, you know, broadswords, tunics, mead. And I love all those things, but that's not what my book is like. Mine is more, you know, kvass and muskets and other things. I wanted to take readers someplace different. And the thing is that even if you don't know anything about Russia, chances are you have pretty strong associations with it. You still probably know the name Rasputin or Anastasia. You probably have images in your head, both beautiful, like Fabergé eggs and the Winter Palace and the Bolshoi Ballet, and brutal, you know, Stalin and the breadlines and gulags and mass graves. And to be frank, those things lend themselves very well to the creation of a fantasy world. But I should say, it's not set in Russia. It's set in a world inspired by Russia that really just uses that as a point of departure.
Yeah, and was that something that you had researched? I mean, did you go through and research it, or did you just...
Yeah. The first draft of the book was really just the plot. It was not even really a whole draft. It was a very rough outline. And then I took about 2 months to do research, and that research really changed a lot of things in the story. In my first draft, Mal and Alina, who you follow throughout the series, had parents, because I wanted to avoid the orphan with powers trope. I thought, you know, well, fantasy authors are always killing off parents. Let's do something a little different. But then in the course of my research, I came across these stories of the Napoleonic Wars, of these officers serving on the front and serving with their serfs for the first time. Many of them returned much changed and with much different attitudes towards these people. And some of them, one freed their serfs, turned his dasha into a home for war widows, another built schools and hospitals. And I needed that to be in the story somehow. And so Mal and Alina's parents had to meet a quick end.
Did you always conceive of it as a trilogy? Are you thinking that far ahead?
To be honest, when I started Shadow and Bone, my only goal was to finish it. It's not the first book I've started, but it's the first book I managed to complete. I would always get about 2 chapters in, and then I would just lose momentum. And so my only goal was to finish it. So the idea that, oh yeah, I'm going to write 3 books was really never... I didn't have that kind of hubris running through my head. But about halfway through the book, I realized that the end I had in mind was really wrong, that there was sort of a larger story arc that I hadn't seen initially. And so I started taking notes for books 2 and 3 and hoping that somebody would want them. And curiously enough, when I went out and I queried agents trying to find somebody to represent me, the person I spoke to and who ended up signing me, Joanna Volpe, said, you know, this feels like a trilogy. Do you see 3 books? And I said, yes, curiously enough, I happen to have the stack of notes right here. And then we got very lucky in that we found a publisher who saw it the same way. But I've had the ending mapped out since the beginning, and a lot of things changed along the way, but that didn't.
It's so interesting that through the process of writing, actually, it sounds like you got momentum to push you further. Were you surprised by that as much as it sounds like?
I mean, honestly, every experience associated with that first book was surprising. And that's true of the second and the third books, too. Every book has been a very steep learning curve. And you think, oh, well, it'll get easier as you go along. But that's not true. Somehow, I think it's a good thing, because maybe it means you're trying to do things that are a little more complex or a little that are pushing you out of your comfort zone. I think each book has its own sort of surprises and challenges to throw your way. I think that there's a certain confidence that builds as you begin to see a story unspool in front of you. And as soon as I had written that first draft and was able to step back from it and see the beginning, middle, and end, I thought, okay, well, actually, maybe I can do this.
And as you've been finishing and put the final point on the third novel, the trilogy's concluded, has that happened again where you started to think a bit further, or are you just going to take a well-deserved break?
It's funny you should ask that. There are no breaks, even if we deserve them. I have already written the new draft for my next book, which is set in the same world as the Grisha trilogy, but in a different country. And it's called The Dregs, has a different set of characters as well. It takes place after the events of the trilogy. There are certain characters, very few, who survive the trilogy that I could see writing books for and whose... I can see these two timelines linking up eventually. And again, when I started out, I never could have imagined, oh, well, maybe this will be, you know, a 6, 7, 8 book cycle. But the world expands and you get these ideas and you want to see where they take you.
Difficult thing about something like that is every time you write something new, you're closing a bit of a door, aren't you? You're creating this whole world, but you have to move in and out of it. Like, people will notice if you get confused. Do you have people helping you?
Yes. I have an amazing editor. We have great copy editors. I mean, and I have wonderful readers. I have friends who I rely on to be additional continuity editors and make sure that that if I said there was a valley there, there's a valley there. But that's also one of the disadvantages of, you know, you're right. Writing a first book is really about throwing all of these doors open. And then all of a sudden, you know, you've sketched a little map that you keep at home. Well, now it's been published and every reader has it in their hands and can say, you know, I think it would actually take them a week to reach this place as opposed to a night. So there are more constraints, and it's definitely one of the things that's quite frankly unappealing about continuing in a single world. But you find ways to kind of to level up and keep it exciting for yourself. And I hope that I'll be able to take time to write outside of the Grisha universe, just because it's fun. I just wrote my first horror story for an anthology called Slasher Girls and Monster Boys, and it's set in our world. It's contemporary, and it was such a pleasure to just write in our world and use our swear words and our foods. You know, if he wants to have a glass of juice, he can just have a glass of juice. You don't have to worry about where the fruit came from and how many peasants died to bring it to his table.
Leigh Bardugo, everybody. The final book in the Grisha trilogy is Ruin and Rising. You can find it anywhere. Thanks so much to her for sitting down and taking the time to talk to us. You can find Leigh on Twitter at L Bardugo. Lastly on the podcast, it's a great pleasure to share an interview we did with David Levithan. I think he's just done amazing things in the realm of young adult literature and literature in general. Super exciting to talk to him about his novel Every Day, but just broadly about young adult literature. So here he is, the wonderful David Levithan.
Hi, this is David Levithan, and my new book is Every Day. It is about somebody named A who every morning since birth has woken up every day in a different body and a different life and has sort of grown used to being detached from life. But then, this is not a spoiler, in the first chapter, A meets a girl named Rhiannon and falls in love with her and suddenly wants to actually connect with somebody for the first time ever.
It strikes me that you've managed to create a character that isn't tied to the things that we normally tie people to, their race, gender, backgrounds. How does that being form themselves through these kind of quite difficult experiences? Where did this kind of feeling of like creating a character basically in a vacuum come from, that desire to do that? Because it's not like Quantum Leap or something where the character exists and then starts jumping into people's body. This being only knows existence from this kind of jump, I guess.
Well, then, I mean, I started the book with that as the question, like, what would your life be like if you didn't have a set body? Because, as you said, you wouldn't have a gender, you wouldn't have a race, you wouldn't have parents, you wouldn't have a set of friends, and you'd really just be a self, that you would totally define yourself by the quality of who you are, not what you look like or what your qualities are and how people see you. And that was a fascinating way to investigate a character, because in the book, every chapter is a different day and thus a different body. And usually when you're an author, if you're in a different character, you want to create a different voice and create a different person. But for this, it was actually the opposite of that. It had to be A inside each one of these people. And maybe a little bit of them would come through, but mostly it just had to be this person who was just a person. And writing it, I had to ask myself, sort of, what are the qualities that define us inherently, and what are the qualities that define us because of what we look like or what our bodies are like?
I mean, there's a nature versus nurture argument in there, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, well, it's both. I mean, the nurture is, of course, because jumping from body to body, you really don't have a consistent life. And nature, it's the question of how much is sort of internal or the soul, and how much is the external and what you look like, and also what society constructs around what you look like.
Yeah. And I guess there's a sense of, like, of real empathy, because, you know, A is going into bodies of, like, there's a bit where there's a suicidal girl, right? And it has to decide whether or not to take some kind of action. But that gives, in a profound way, like, genuinely going into somebody's skin, which is kind of, I guess, maybe what you've been doing as an author for quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely... it is taking on characters is what the author does. But I think what was fascinating to me, because I really didn't think it out, I just started writing it, was that I thought A would be obsessed with the differences between people, that, oh my goodness, every day I'm in a different person. But then very quickly I realized, no, actually, if you had to navigate this life, you would in fact emphasize the commonality, that you would see how similar people are. And so A is more empathetic because A is really looking at sort of the 99% of us that are the same and not fixating on the 1% that's different, whereas we, as normal people who live in our bodies every day, we tend to obsess over the differences we have between us and other people, whereas A does not.
The whole idea of the love story then inside of that idea of, like, trying to be in love with somebody and have a relationship with somebody while kind of constantly shifting who you are, well, not who you are, but where you are and what body you're in, speaks a lot about an idea of love that is higher, maybe?
Well, that was the second question I had to ask when writing the book is, okay, could Rhiannon genuinely love somebody who does change every day? I mean, if you're in a relationship, you know that even small changes, oh, you've cut your hair, it looks so great. I mean, that can throw you for a loop. They're superficial changes, but you're so used to somebody the way that they are, that when they change, you have to adjust. And sometimes you can't. Most of the time you can. But for Rhiannon, the changes are extraordinary. I mean, A is a small Asian girl one day and a big black boy the next day and a white girl the next day. Like, it changes all the time. And so how can Rhiannon grapple with that? If you know, we always say, I love the person inside. Well, the question I had to pose was, can you genuinely love the person inside no matter what the outside is? And I didn't know what the answer was going to be until I was writing the book.
Seriously, you didn't know? You there at any point you could have just been like, that's never mind, love is doomed, no such thing?
Yeah, no, I really, I mean, there was sort of the angel and the devil on my shoulder, because the angel was like, oh, love will conquer all, love is wonderful. And the devil was like, are you kidding me? You can't love just anybody. You have a type. Everybody has a type. And so it was interesting. Within the book, you see those two voices arguing back and forth.
Do you find yourself as a person, like, being less superficial, maybe? Or were you, or was it coming from a place of, like, I change a lot? Because I know certainly when I'm in a relationship, you know, one day I'm in a good mood and one day I'm totally miserable. And do you know, like, it seems to be a metaphor for that kind of feeling of, like, the way somebody is in a relationship, where, like, these small, like you said, the small changes. Were you experiencing that? Where did this kind of idea to take this on come from? Was that a personal thing, or was it just an abstract idea that was in your head?
Well, I think it started as sort of the abstract idea of, oh, waking up every morning in a different body. That was really the one line, what I was interested in. But then when writing it, the weird thing was, more than looking at relationships, it was more looking at myself and looking, how am I defined by my body? Which is such a basic question to ask yourself. And on some levels, I mean, certainly have looked into sort of sexuality and male privilege and being white, and you think of that, but then there are other more complicated things. I mean, the notions of genetics and the notions of sort of we are who our family is, and what if you didn't have a family, who would you become, and the nature and nurture of it. It really raised a lot of questions that I don't think I answer entirely in the book, but it was fascinating to look at how I define myself, and also how much I allowed other people to define me by the physical manifestation of myself.
I love these challenges that you seem to take on when you write What drives you to take on these really difficult kind of either subject matters? I mean, you've taken on AIDS, September 11th. I mean, some massive, massive big ideas in there, right?
Yeah, I mean, because I think I do want to challenge myself that it you do see the easy road. I mean, I always, when I talk to young writers, I say the cruel trick of being an author is that you struggle so hard to find your voice, and then the minute you do, you don't want to use it because you want to keep it interesting. And so with Boy Meets Boy, my first novel, I mean, it was a dippy, happy, gay love story that was very well received. And you know what? I could have just written a dippy, happy, gay love story every year for a good number of years, and many people would have been very happy with that. But the minute that I was like, oh, this is what a David Levithan novel is, I wanted to write different things. So my next novel after that, Realm of Possibility, was in verse, and then I wrote in third person, and then I wrote a retelling of A Christmas Carol, and then I wrote a 9/11 book. And so
the dictionary, the
Lover's Dictionary, yeah. I love playing with form, and one of the reasons I love collaboration so much is that when you're writing with somebody else, they bring out a book in you that you would never in a million years write yourself. And so it's using the other person as a catalyst to go different places that you would never go because you're sharing the driving wheel, which is scary. But I'm always, when I'm thinking about what will I write next, I think, okay, which one is the scariest or most challenging? And that's usually the one I go for.
It's such an interesting way. And certainly with collaboration, my experience has been exactly the same, whereas there's a freedom that opens you up because somebody, and also as a writer, you get to just throw things in that you don't know where it's going to go. But you don't have to worry about that. You just pass it on. And you're like, yep, do something with that bit.
Yeah, I mean, if you read Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, my first collaboration with Rachel Cohen, I mean, it is all, I mean, it's two kids from New Jersey and New York over the course of a night falling in love and out of love and in love and out of love numerous times with various things happening. And the energy of it comes from Rachel and I emailing chapters back and forth and totally messing with each other and totally being like, ha, here's a Hugo. Where are you going to go with that? And ha, you thought that they were going to end up together right now, but she is leaving the building right now. And that spontaneity is why there's such an energy in the novel for readers. It's just this constant things up in the air because that's what life is like.
Have you been able to take that from that feeling of spontaneity from the collaborations? Has it changed the way you write books afterwards? Do you know what I mean? Like, I find that when I, you know, doing that, I sometimes will pretend that I'm collaborating with somebody, even if I'm just writing by myself.
Somehow, I've found a way in my solo work, not even to collaborate necessarily, but to almost have a virtual collaboration. Like, for example, Two Boys Kissing, the book that I have that just came out. I didn't collaborate with anybody on it, but I did actually start reading it out loud as I was writing it to my friend Joel. And I had not planned on that. But it was really interesting because the book is told in a first-person plural voice. And the voice was so important to me, I really had to hear it. And it wasn't enough just to sit alone in my apartment and read it aloud to myself. So that became part of the ritual of writing the book, was reading it aloud to him. And I actually understood the book much better because I was reading it out loud to him. And partially he was not allowed to give feedback. He just sort of sat there because I just needed him to be a listener. But at the same time, there was the intimacy of that, of telling the story just to one specific person, that did translate into the writing because I wanted it to have that intimacy, which I wouldn't have had if I had been reading it to myself or reading it to a whole bunch of people in a room.
Yeah, that feeling, it's intangible, but it's there.
Yeah, and so he became sort of a silent collaborator. So I think that it has opened me up. My first couple of books, I was not a very big sharer. I would sit alone in my apartment, I would write the book, and then my editor would be the first person to read it. But now I will share it more as I'm writing, or I will talk to people about it, and that does inform it. And I think the collaborations are what opened that up for me.
When you started writing, because it was Boy Meets Boy was the first novel, that book was incredibly well received, and it was received well because of the shift in tone when it dealt with homosexual characters. Do you think that tone has irrevocably shifted, or do you feel like it continues to be a problem that in fiction stereotypes are presented as a very one-dimensional kind of character that doesn't take into account actual human experience? Because I think that's the most important thing about that book, and what was so revolutionary about it was it took people's actual lives into consideration as opposed to their one-dimensional, hey, you are a blank, you know?
No, I think, I mean, in the past 10 years, I mean, the book came out 10 years ago, things have changed immeasurably. I mean, I don't think the range has shifted over. I think the range has just broadened because I think there are more realistic, more happy, sad books and just very much about life. And there are still the tragic stories. And I don't think Boy Meets Boy was not written to erase the tragic stories. I think you really do need the full spectrum. I think the reason I wrote Boy Meets Boy was because there were only tragic stories. And if you were a gay kid or a straight kid who wanted to read about gay kids reading YA literature, you only read about doomed or miserable kids. And I wanted to rewrite that. I mean, not only. There were with some very notable exceptions. But mostly it was about the bleakness of being gay. And I wanted to rewrite that. And luckily, in 2003, when the book first came out, there were other authors like Brett Hartinger, Julian Peters, who had the same thought and parallel to each other. We all wrote these books that broadened the base. And because we opened the door, a lot of other people since then have come through. And it has led to a much more realistic portrayal of gay characters, not just as main characters, but even secondary characters in books. You see now that the gay characters are given more complex lives than they had in the past. It used to be they were the one-note gay best friend, but now that's really more complex.
David Levithan, everybody. The book is Every Day. He's got a great body of work. Make sure to seek it out. Thanks so much to him, Lee Bardugo, and Garth Nix. And a special thank you, of course, to Sasha DeBoole for doing the Garth Nix interview with us. And, of course, thank you very much for listening. It's been a huge pleasure being in your ears. Pop the earbuds out now. Kick up your heels and enjoy a good book. Be transported to another world. Imagine yourself far, far away from where you are. Until next time, goodbye for now.